The adventures and hardships of a life dedicated to humanitarian work are on full display in the new memoir Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid, written by 36-year-old Jessica Alexander, a former Fulbright scholar who is currently an adjunct professor at both Columbia University, Fordham University, and New York University. The book is a look at an all-consuming, dangerous, and often romanticized line of work. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jessica Alexander to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The subtitle of the book, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. How did you get in?
Well, it was a personal life event. My mother passed away, and that I was 22 years old. I had just graduated college, and it really forced me to reevaluate what I was doing in my career. And at that time, I was working in advertising and not really feeling fulfilled in that role, but, you know, still I was 22. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And in fact, I didn't even know that this profession existed. I knew that I wanted to have a meaningful career, and I also knew that I was somewhat allured by the travel and the global lifestyle that it could potentially have. And so I just started applying for as many jobs as possible, but was quickly humbled because I was rejected by almost every single one of them until I just kept persisting and found my feet at a small but growing development organization based in New York.
Before we talk a little bit about your first landing, why do you think you were rejected? I would think you would take whoever would come through the door willing to do this incredible work.
Well, I write about this in the book. You know, I was naive as well, and I thought that, gosh, helping people, you know, I'm educated. I have 4 years of college, 4-year college degree, and why wouldn't they take me? And I'm motivated and enthusiastic, but this is a profession, and it requires skills, and it requires expertise, and it requires master's degrees. And, you know, it's not enough just to be motivated. We go in, and we're working under really harsh circumstances and with really tough issues. And people in these places that we go, they deserve professionals to be working there, not just enthusiastic 22-year-olds like I was. So I was able to use some of the skills that I developed at my marketing career, which is funny because I was only there for a few months. But, you know, whatever skills I had learned, I adapted those to the work that I was doing in this development organization and got my foot, you know, my foot in the door as a PR assistant. So that's how I got in. But I didn't have any skills or knowledge at that point to be qualified to go out into the field. And so I was appropriately rejected.
You first landed in Rwanda in the aftermath of the 1994 genocide. So what is that like to have that be the first assignment?
Well, it was in 2003, so aftermath meaning, you know, a 9-year period. And the country was stable, and it's a beautiful, amazing country. And it was my first entry into the world of aid, not in the textbook. It was a summer internship between my first and second year at Columbia, and I had been reading about this place and reading about what had happened there, and so it was quite illuminating to go and to see just how wonderful the people were, because you read about these things and you wonder how people could do these things and they must be so different, when actually they're just people and they got caught up in a horrible few months of hell. And it was a really wonderful experience.
You write in the book about corruption and inefficiencies and incompetence that is out there in this field, which makes your initial point all the more resonant about why we need people who have more than just enthusiasm. Did the inefficiencies and the corruption surprise you?
Well, I was, when I learned about it, and I think it was really, you know, my second field posting where I had more responsibilities than just being an intern, it was in Darfur. And when we say corruption, you know, it was corruption in the sense of I was working in a 24,000-person internally displaced persons camp. And people from the neighboring town or the other camp would try to come in and forge these cards that would give them access to services. And so that kind of corruption existed. It was about, 10% of the population that we registered would, try to do these things. But when you think about it, I mean, we put them through a lot of hassles to get access to these cards. They had to stand in lines. They had to fill out forms, et cetera. I mean, these were people who were desperate for services as well. And so when I say corruption, sort of with a grain of salt, that happens. It was at in circumstances where people were desperate to get services, whether or not they were displaced or not.
Why do you think that the line of work is often romanticized, which is something it seems in the book that is a point that you're trying to make, that it's never as glamorous as you think it will be?
Sure. I think people, when I came home, they were saying, "Oh, you're an amazing person. You're a saint. You're just like Mother Teresa." And you think, "Gosh, I don't know whether I achieved anything in that last posting," you know? And so people imagine that you're out there and saving the world, and it's really much more complex than that, and your day-to-day contribution can be much smaller. And so you sometimes leave thinking, "God, I may have done this very small piece in this huge, overwhelming, vast sea of needs that, you feel like, gosh, I hope I raised the bar, I thought I raised the bar maybe 2 miles when in fact I raised it 2 centimeters. And so people romanticize the kind of people that go into it, that we're all these saints and amazing, wonderful people, when we're actually just human beings who are committed to the mission and want to do a good job, but also are just like them. We're professionals and this is our career. And I think people also romanticize the travel. And absolutely, there's something very alluring about the global lifestyle that we lead. But in a lot of places, you're really lonely and you're living in rough conditions. And so that's not really the reality, that we're just hopping on planes and running around and leading this global glamorous lifestyle. I mean, I don't know whether anyone would say it was glamorous, but we do have access to some, pretty amazing places, but it can be quite harsh sometimes.
Where do you see the results? In actually doing the work and working one-on-one with individuals often, where do you see the results that are payment beyond the career aspect?
You mean the individual relationship?
Yes.
Well, yes. What I would say is, as you move up in this career, unfortunately, the less access you have to affected people. You're usually working in an office, planning logistics, managing programs, and it's your national staff who are actually out in the field delivering it and making it happen. And I think you see the results in just small everyday victories. So you can go into a community where there are malnourished children and your program, is run, and you come back a few weeks later and the children are up on their feet and getting on with it. You go into a community where you do a teacher training or you help build a school with the community, and you come back and children are in school and they're learning and their literacy and numeracy rates go up. Again, these are, small-scale projects, but they do make an impact, and I think that's what keeps us going, is these small victories that are seen on a very small scale. Now, working in headquarters, I'm removed from a lot of these things, and you have to keep reminding yourself sometimes why you're doing it and the people there whose lives you can impact, because we're really removed from it when we sit in Geneva or New York.
Is there something that there is an expiration date on it, that there's a point after doing this work for a long time that it's probably good to move on?
I think for everyone it's different. Some people continue to do this in the field and they love that lifestyle. For me, that wasn't the case. I mean, I've come back and I work now in policy and teach, as you mentioned in the beginning of the interview, and that's where I get a lot of satisfaction. Am I done with time in the field? Maybe not. I don't know yet. I think at some point people have to reevaluate whether the lifestyle is working for them and whether putting their personal lives on hold, if that is the case. Some people make their personal lives fine and happen successfully in the field. For me, that wasn't the case, and I wanted to come home and decided to reprioritize a few things in my life and still be engaged in this work, but in a different way.
When you have something, just using it as an example, like the massive earthquake in Haiti, how much time do you have to make an actual decision as to whether you're going to go or not?
Well, what happened then is, obviously, I saw it happen. I felt that tug to go and wanting to help respond. And I applied for a bunch of jobs, and I got one. And then it was like, we need you on the ground tomorrow. So, you know, I made the decision to apply and put myself out there. And then it's like, we are understaffed, under-resourced. We got to get as bodies on the ground. And so you've got to gear up and get there as quickly as they need you.
But I assume that those opportunities come a lot, unfortunately, where you have the option of feeling that tug or not.
Absolutely. And yes, you do. I mean, we haven't seen, luckily, a disaster on the magnitude of Haiti since 2010. But certainly, you know, there are opportunities to go respond in numerous crises from here. So yes, the opportunity is always there, and you have to kind of decide whether you're going to put yourself out there again or whether, you know, working from home is where you want to be.
And working from home can be very beneficial. I mean, that work has to be done as well.
Absolutely. And so when people are donating to organizations and they think it's all going to overhead or headquarters, I mean, these are really important jobs that are being done as well that allow the programs on the ground to happen. And so they're, you know, they're just as important. I mean, I think people sometimes aren't aware of all of the work that goes on at a headquarters level.
The name of the book is Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. It is published by Broadway Books. Jessica Alexander, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A delight to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book is Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. It is published by Broadway Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.